KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. You're listening to Radio Orbit. My name is Mike Hagan, not Debbie Johnson. And I'll be back with y'all in just a few minutes.
We saw much we don't know.
Alrighty, there you have it. KOPN Columbia, it's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit, 89.5 FM, about 8 minutes now after 11 p.m. on the 14th of May. Halfway through the month of May. Alright, how about it? And here we go again. Every Monday we do this from 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. in the morning, sometimes later, like tonight when Ruthie's not going to show up. But we always start things off, as we should, saying thank you to Debbie Johnson. As always, Free Range Radio Theater, 10 p.m. until 11 p.m., 1 hour before this program. Debbie does it every week, bringing you great radio theater. Tonight, no different. It was awesome. Arsenic and Old Lace, and a great production of that from BBC, I think it was. Wonderful stuff that I remember from high school, as a matter of fact. Ever since, quite frankly. Anyway, thanks to Debbie. Speaking of Debbie's, thanks to Debbie in Chicago, my friend and an amazing person, and also to her friend, Janice. The show dedicated to her tonight, Janice, that is, and anyone else, actually, the show tonight, anyone who's so busy fixing the rest of the world that they forgot to fix themselves. All right, before Debbie Johnson, Kelvin and Jason doing it up, jazz plus blues equals summertime. Summertime for sure. It's here. Tech Radio, as always, interesting stuff for those guys, keeping things going and getting us informed on the amazing world of high-tech wizardry, far-out science. Some great stories on Tech Radio tonight. Justin, John, doing a great job. Jeff Wheeler starts things off every Monday with Uncommon Light from 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Great radio on KOPN. You got to love it. Your imagination station. It's great to be here with you and part of it all. All right, thanks to everybody who listened and enjoyed the program last week. Big thank you to Mary Getton, very nice woman, doing good work and sharing knowledge about other species with our own. So thank you, Mary. We'll have all the links up in the archives page for others to check out. And if you're interested, Mary's on the web at marygetten, marygetten.com. All right, we also heard, what did we do? We did independent music for sure last week, Compliments of Mid-Missouri. The music scene here, a bunch of my friends who played a couple weeks ago in a benefit concert for KOPN down at the Blue Fugue. And so we sort of gave props to them last week and played a bunch of their songs. We also raised about $700 for the station. It was great. Had a good time and had a little effort there to raise money for KOPN. And I appreciate everyone for making it happen and everyone who came down and participated and danced it up and, you know, donated a little of your money to the station. Anyway, if you missed that show last week, or any other for that matter, the talk or the music, it's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com. In the program archives, you can go check it out for yourselves, share it with your pals if you like it. If you don't, you know what to do with it. All right, tonight, me and you haven't had a chance in a while to air some of the things on my own laundry list, I guess. So tonight we'll do that. As for music, I was going to play a collection of stuff that I've sort of been requested to play over the last few months. You know, the music that I play, I get emails and stuff, and people say, well, I like this one, I like that one, and you should play that one again and all that. So I was going to do that, but at the last minute, I decided that I wasn't going to. I wanted to play Sunkill Moon, Mark Kozelek's band, his most recent project. So anyway, I've played them before on the program, and tonight I'm going to feature music from... It's not new, but it's the most recent thing that that Mark Kozelek did with Sunkill Moon. It's called Ghosts of the Great Highway. And we started things off there with a song called Salvador Sanchez. Great stuff. One of my favorite musicians around these days. And, of course, he was the primary power or the primary creative power, I guess I should say, behind Red House Painters. And then he has a couple of CDs just under his own name, Mark Kozelek. But he's a real talented writer and a great songster and a great guitar player. So anyway, we'll play a song here, speaking of that, called Floating. I'll come back in a minute and I don't know what we'll do. But tonight's going to be fun. I've got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. We'll do space weather. We'll do... we'll have a chance to talk about some news that we haven't done in a while. I've got a little... business that I want to take care of at the midnight hour. That'll probably take an hour or so. And then after that, We'll take calls or peek in the chat room for sure, and I'm sure there'll be questions and comments and all that stuff, as there always is. And, well, we'll just get on with it, okay? Thank you, all of you, for listening tonight, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And one more time, this is Sun Kill Moon. The song is called Floating. It's off a song, I'm sorry, off a CD called Ghosts of the Great Highway. Back in a few minutes. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Song called Floating. Again, Sun Kill Moon from Ghosts of the Great Highway. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Yeah, the Imagination Station coming to you at the 11 o'clock hour every Monday night from Mid-Missouri's own KOPN right down here on lovely Broadway, 915 East, as a matter of fact, up here in the Dalton Building, if you ever want to pop in and say hi. If you're a friendly type, you know what I mean? Anyway, hello to everyone out there listening this evening on the traditional airwaves or over the internet. Whether you listen live or otherwise, every Monday we do it 11 p.m. And if you're outside the mid-Missouri region here, we broadcast for, what, about 50-mile radius outside of Columbia, maybe 60 on a good night, I think. But you can always listen live on the internet at kopn.org. And that's going to improve, by the way, too. We've got a new transmitter that we've yet to install, but we're working on some improvements at the site where we have to put the transmitter in, thanks to all the people that have, been so generous with their money to help us do this, and we really appreciate it. It was an expensive project, and we're still in the middle of it, but, man, when that new transmitter's up there, it'll be great, and it'll really improve the... I guess the reliability, number one, of the signal, and I think it'll improve the probably the distance a little bit and the clarity and all that stuff. So, anyway, it's good news, and we'll have it up as soon as we can. Trust me, David and the gang are working really hard to do it, and we know everybody out there's, you know, looking forward to it as well. You know, we'll also keep the old transmitter on hand, and then if we ever have to do, you know, required maintenance and all this stuff, like you should be doing, you know, scheduled maintenance so the thing doesn't bust, you just fire up the old transmitter, let that run for a day, give it a little workout, you know, just like an old car, you like to run it once in a while, and just leave it in the garage. Otherwise, it really does, you know, sort of die. But if you run it once in a while, it sort of digs it. And anyway, you do your maintenance on the new car, or the new transmitter, as it were, and then, you know, you switch them again, put the new one back on the air. So that's what we're planning on doing. We've got a lot of things going on here at the station, thanks to the people that support it. You have no idea what it means to us here, and I guess we don't really know what it means to you guys either, but apparently enough to help us keep doing what we do. So thank you, whoever you are. You know who you are, all right? All right, what else? Speaking of friends, on the web, www.cosmicwavesradio. These guys are great people, and they've been providing a stream for me on Monday nights for about a year now, as a matter of fact. And long before KOPN was streaming on our own, these guys made it available to me through a little bit of a, you know, we had a little bit of a hijack situation here in one of the studios, but we've been able to put the show live on the internet since last May. And thanks to Carrie and Paul and all the other guys over there and girls, whoever's involved, thank you so much. And we still broadcast on Cosmic Waves Radio every Monday night. Okay, so thanks to all those people who make that happen, here, there, everywhere. Larry, the web wizard, as always, he's back in Hawaii, busy as hell, but we've got a new design for the website up, and it's looking cool. Got a few things trying to tweak out, just stick with us, all right? Working things out, as you know. All right, that's sort of what the show is about tonight, working things out. Anyway, thanks as well to all the people out there sending art, music, poetry. Lots of new stuff. If you just go snoop around on the website, send more, we'll find a place for it, and we'll share it with other people, okay? Check it out. Let me know what you think. Just go over to Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. You'll have access to everything that we're doing over there, and just go take a look and see, all right? Share your thoughts with me. I appreciate it. The forum, which we have, which is just sort of a one click away from the primary website there, is always busy. There's always interesting things being talked about. Topics being discussed, you know, news and whatever, and lots of really cool and smart people, more than I can keep up with, but they're there all the time, and when I do the news, I usually just go over to the forum now. I don't have to, it's a great clearinghouse for interesting stuff. I don't have to go to a bunch of different sites. I just sort of pop into my own forum, and I trust that the people that are hopping in and out of there from day to day and from hour to hour, whatever, as frequently as they decide to spend their time there, I suspect, and I then always am granted with my wish that great stories are up there in the forum, and then I get to read them and comment on them if I like, and anybody else can do the same. So anyway, if you're interested in that stuff, check it out on the web, as always, and there's a live chat going on during the program every Monday night, and hello to everybody over there. Haven't peeked in there yet, but I'm sure there's at least a few of you, as there always is. So I appreciate it, and I love you guys all. All right? Okay, I encourage my guests, although we don't have one tonight, I always encourage guests as well as listeners to join us in the chat room and in the forum. And, you know, it's all about finding the others and communicating. All right? So my email address, speaking of that, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send me email. Send my guests email, send musicians that appear on the program email. Everybody likes to hear from you, good, bad, and ugly. It's always, you know, something to keep the day interesting, if nothing else. The phone number here in the studio, if we decide to take some phone calls, which we might after 1 o'clock, the number 573-443-8255, okay? And if you want to call me in the studio and not be on the air, you know, during... when I put a song on or something like that, you can call it 573-874-5676, okay? Whew. All right, let's see. 25 after or so. Let me tell you a little bit about what we'll do over the next few weeks, okay? Tonight, as I said, we'll take a breather, catch up on the news, give me a chance to chat about a few things that have been on my mind, and probably interact with you guys in the chat room and on the telephones later on during the program, if you're willing. What else? Next week, Paul Laffoley. Oh, yeah. You know, we've become friends off the air in the last 3 months since he was on the program, and I'm really excited to have Paul back on. He's an amazing artist and architect, a polymath by many people's definition, my own, a person who was admittedly autistic as a child, but in my opinion, he's just an amazing person, and you'll find out more about him next week. But he has a photographic memory, by the way, and I don't think he's capable of lying, for those of you out there who are listening to this. So anyway, there are reasons that I say that. You'll all find out about it next week if you didn't listen to the previous program with Paul Laffoley. But he's a wonderful artist, an architect, a visionary person who is just out of this world, man. Incredible guy. We'll have him next week, back by popular demand, Paul Laffoley. Check him out on the web in the meantime, okay? L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y. Let's see, the week after that, the 28th is open, but I think there are a couple things that may fall in there. I'm not going to mention them yet, but I think, well, maybe B. Wilson and maybe Neil Adams. We'll have to see. But the week after that, Gary David, the guy who wrote Orion and the Hopi. We'll have him on the 4th of June. And then, well, after that, Dr. Richard Tarnas sometime in the next couple of months. John Major Jenkins, he and I are speaking. We're just trying to figure out a time when. I can't wait to have John back on the air. Rick Miller, Richard Allen Miller, another guy who I'm sort of becoming friends with off the air. He'll be back on the program this summer. Michael and Star, I'm not sure what's up with them. They were going to go to Russia. I'm not sure if they actually left or not. Dennis, of course, wearing my Terrence T-shirt tonight. Here's to you, my brother. And tonight, music from Sunkill Moon. Got a lot of good music lined up for the next few weeks as well, okay? Okay, announcements. Thanks to those of you who pledged your support for the station. We successfully raised $30,000 plus, and, well, we did a great job of helping the station out, and we're going to do it as much as we need to in the future, but we bought ourselves another 6 months or so, or whatever it is, probably not even that much. The station has a budget of about $300,000 a year. So what's that? Divided by 12, is that about, I don't know, less than $3,000 or less than $30,000 a month. Right, it's about $25,000 a month. Right? So we just got a month's worth with that $30,000 that we raised, a little more than that. But we also get matching funds from the crooks in Washington. You know, we take some of their dirty money, but we do it anyway. I'd love to not have to take a dime from those scumbags, but we do it anyway because we want to stay on the air. You know, if you want to see us be really independent with no strings whatsoever, then you really got to pony up. But I would love to see it happen, and you know, in my vision, it's going to happen where we can actually, you know, raise the flag and finger to all of them. Okay, announcements. Royal Raymond Rife, one of my absolute heroes. He was born on May 16th, 1888, and died actually on August 5th. But anyway, he was an amazing person. He was a scientist, and people don't really understand much about Rife. Even people that think they do, I think, haven't really studied the man himself. They've studied some of the pieces of equipment and stuff that supposedly he designed, but his background and stuff is remarkable. And it goes all the way back to the Timken steel family, the Timken Bearing Company, and his remarkable inventions to help them revolutionize the steel industry, essentially, because we have time tonight. So Royal Rife, what he did long before he discovered a cure for cancer and built with his own hands microscopes that have yet to be recreated to this day, nearly 100 years ago. Royal Rife began his career as a, he worked for Henry Timken, and he was a friend of Timken's daughter, but he was always interested in all this funky stuff, and he was interested in sound and light and the way wave theory in general. He loved anything that had to do with waves. So anyway, he taught Timken that the way to look at his steel that was coming in from U.S. Steel and Bethlehem Steel and wherever else, he made a little machine that could actually send, you know, a sound wave into the steel that was being delivered and detect microfractures and problems inside the steel billet. And therefore, you know, see, they used to make bearings. They would make bearings, but they would, shit, pardon me, but, you know, 40%, 50% of them were junk. They had to scrap them. And they had no recourse back to the manufacturer, back to the steel manufacturer. They could ship them junk all day. But this was one of the primary things that sort of revolutionized quality control, because Rife gave Timken a way to actually hold the steel manufacturers accountable. You know, we should learn a lesson from that, holding people accountable. But anyway, and that's exactly what happened. Timken put the stuff right back on a truck and sent it back to U.S. Steel or whoever and said, I'm not going to pay for this. It's junk. It's got defects in it, and I can prove it. Well, what happened? Well, the steel companies had to, you know, revolutionize their own business. They had to get better at what they did. And so anyway, Rife moved along, but he was forever loved and ingratiated to by Henry Timken. And Timken gave him a whole bunch of money, and he had his own laboratory right there on Timken's estate property, and big money, right? Timken's still around today. Of course, it's probably, who knows, you know, what's happening over there today, but at any rate, they were the reason that Royal Rife was able to do what he did as far as the financial side of his work, until later in his work when he was screwed by the AMA and Fishburne and all those punks. But anyway, he was able to do all this amazing stuff, and he was a machinist. He actually built the stuff with his own hands. And that's why no one's been able to replicate what he did, because he did it with his own hands, and very few people even have the skill that this guy had as a machinist. He made a microscope, a number of them. I think he called it a universal microscope. But anyway, it ended up being called the Rife microscope and this and that. But he, to this day, was able to see things that only now, I think, is the technology allowing us in the medical world to see what Rife was able to see in the 1920s. Essentially, he was able to watch living viruses, things that are so small that normally you have to stain them and look at them with an electron microscope. Well, he was able to see these things in a living state. And, you know, the difference between that, well, it's basically like, you know, being able to watch a motion picture or just see a still photo. If you see a still photo, you've only caught one moment, and in this case, a dead moment when you're looking at microorganisms. But Rife was able to look at these things in their living state. Well, when you can look at them in their living state, you can find out a lot more about them than when they're dead. That's a note to science, by the way. You know, biology, the study of life. Very interesting how the study of life usually, starts off with killing it. I would suggest the work of Rupert Sheldrake and the wonderful book that he wrote in maybe 1980, A New Science of Life. You know, it's always been my opinion that the way to learn about life is to look at it alive and in its natural environment. At any rate, Rife was able to do this with microorganisms, and he discovered amazing things. And when you're able to look at something alive, you can also determine what kills it. And, again, Rife was a master with regard to sonic technology and all this stuff, and that's exactly what he did. He combined these two things, this amazing microscope, where he was able to visually identify and observe microorganisms, you know, everything from anthrax to, who knows what, but viruses, things that and things also called, you know, filterable bacteria, things that are so small that you can't keep them on a slide. Anyway, he was able to observe all this stuff in a living state. And then he also developed this particular machine. I don't know what else to call it, but it was basically, they called it the, and it sounds so cheesy, so 1950s B movie, but they called it the beam ray device. No kidding. Royal Raymond Rife's beam ray. This is what they called it, you know. Well, stranger than science fiction, because what Rife was able to do was observe these particular organisms, whatever they might be, and then apply different frequencies of sound to them while he was watching them. And, you know, well, there are things that are very beneficial from sound. The work of this amazing scientist in Japan, Emoto, right? What he does with water shows that different frequencies of sound, different words, affect the crystal structure of the water. Well, in the same way, what Rife would do was generate these different frequencies of sound. And again, no one really knows how he did it, because he did all this stuff himself, and people have tried to repeat it, and it's sort of like the magician's apprentice. People just bumble, sort of. You know, because no one's been able to equal this guy. But at any rate, he would find the right frequency that was a dissonant frequency that would literally disrupt the cell metabolism, and whatever particular thing that he had it tuned to would just destroy itself. And so, as we know now, everything around us, every cell in our body, type of cell at least, everything has a particular vibration to it. You know, the electron spin resonance, as the Psi guys like to talk about it and all this stuff, right? Well, for all of these things, there are different frequencies that affect them in different ways. Well, if you can find a frequency that really messes up with the operating frequency of a particular cell, it will destroy the cell. And, this is what happens to the whales and dolphins, you know, when they bombard them with low-frequency active sonar, essentially. You know, it's sort of a macro version of the same thing. But at any rate, Rife was able to do this, and he identified 300, 400 some different pathogens and was able to kill them. He cured cancer in hundreds of patients, documented, worked through the University of Southern California, was considered an absolute legend in his field before the 1930s. And he was systematically destroyed, discredited, and to this day, you know, there aren't very many medical students that even know his name. Because why? Well, because he actually cured things. In other words, you know, he didn't treat them. And this is the problem of the medical industry. The medical industry is not interested in cure. They're interested in treatment from here to eternity, okay? That's what they're interested in, whether you like it or not. That's just the way it goes, okay? Because the pharmaceutical companies run the show. Whether you think they do or not, they do. They make all the rules, and they pay big bucks to have it their way. But your job, you know, as a thinking American person, is to not, you know, be fooled by the propaganda. So, one way to do that is to go check out Royal Raymond Rife and find out for yourself. All right, you think I'm whistling Dixie. Royal Raymond Rife. All right, May 16th, 1888, he was born. Here's to you, my friend. Who else did I want to talk about? I did a great show, by the way, with Sean Montgomery, one of the few people who really does know about Rife. He made a great couple of videos. Sean Montgomery, and Google his name or go to my website and listen to that program with Sean. I think there's information there about the videos, because they're pretty informative and pretty telling about, you know, what's happening in medicine. All right, who else? Bertrand Russell, birthday, Friday, May 18th. I've spoken about Bertrand Russell before. He's a wonderful guy, did great things for mathematics and the sciences in general, brought a little bit of humility back into the whole game, although very few remember. But I do, and I appreciate it, Bertrand. him and Alfred North Whitehead and, you know, Kurt Gödel and a whole bunch of them. Anyway, here's to Bertrand Russell. Like I say, Friday, May 18th, 1872, born. All right. Let's see. I think I'll play a piece of music and we'll come back and do space weather. All right? Or should I just do space weather and then play a piece of music? No, I want to play a piece of music. I'm going to take a break. This is called Gentle Moon. I'll get over myself here. KOPN Columbia, it's Mike Hagen. You listen to Radio Orbit. Sun Kill Moon from Ghosts of the Great Highway. called Gentle Moon again, Sunkill Moon. One of my favorite bands. I love this guy, Mark Kozelak. You can find out information on the web at Sunkill Moon. It's S-U-N-K-I-L-M-O-O-N. I think sunkillmoon.com. And Mark Kozelak is, he's got a whole bunch of different projects, but pretty easy to find. So just get creative out there with Google or whatever search engine you decide to use, okay? All right, let's do space weather. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, by the way, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Asteroids flying by. Discovered just a few days ago, a couple of people in Arizona, this asteroid they've identified as 2007JZ2, zipping past the Earth today. Just under 2 million miles away, but that's pretty close in cosmic terms. And if you're in the southern hemisphere, you probably see that thing at night. Tonight, I guess, was that earlier this morning or later today? I get all confused when I think about New Zealand and Australia, but regardless, big telescopes down there looking at that thing, and pretty faint, maybe 19th magnitude, but space rock cruising by, and in the constellation of Pavo and Indus, if you're looking for it, if you still have time. And if you want to see the ephemeris, the whole orbital of this thing, of course, just go to spaceweather.com. You can see where it's been and where it's going. But it doesn't stick around for long, 30,000 miles per hour or so, they say it goes. Imagine one of those things smacking into you. It's happened before. Whew. And they very, you know, and like I always say, it's not the ones you know about. And there's a whole lot you don't know about. This one discovered just a few days ago. It's always happening. In fact, there's, you know, for every one they discover, there's a billion, what, how many that they didn't, you know? Wouldn't it be strange? What a weird irony that would be. You know, we're sitting down here, everyone's busting their hump about nuclear waste and, you know, eliminating CO2 emissions and all this sort of thing and, you know, trying to get green and bring the planet back to her garden past and all this sort of thing. And then all of a sudden a rock smacks into you and you think, oh, my God, we should have been stockpiling plutonium. We should have been building starships the size of Manhattan. We should have gotten the hell out of here while we had the chance. You know? So you have to be sort of careful where you put your efforts because you really don't know what's coming. And, you know, all you have to do is study deep time and the physiology of the planet. And you'll see pretty quickly that evolution and the universe are capable of taking sharp left turns. And usually when you least expect it. So there's a tip. Expect the unexpected. All right, speaking of unexpected, a new sunspot forming near the sun's eastern limb. Just a few hours ago, some good photos up now on the web if you're interested in that sort of thing. And really cool to watch the magnetic fields of these things wrap around and morph as the things sort of take shape. And, of course, they're always in flux. It's a dynamic situation. But really cool to watch and lots of interesting images up there on the web. And you can see that stuff at Kent Stedman's site all the time, cyberspaceorbit.com. He's always linked up. If he doesn't have it on the front page, he's always got links over to the solar people. And Space Weather does a great job as well. I use a lot of their stuff on the show here. I appreciate it. Okay, Green Comet, that one I've been talking about. I haven't said anything in about a month, but Comet Lovejoy, C2007E2. Not that bright to see it with the naked eye. But beautiful sea green comet, really looks nice. If you've got a reasonably sized telescope, set it up in the backyard, and you know, you can go take a look at it as it's cruising. The comet right now looks at about, well, it's about the brightness of an eighth magnitude star. They say it's big. Right now it's glowing, you know, the coma of the thing is bigger than Jupiter. Doesn't mean that, you know, the comet itself, the nucleus of it is, you know, it's sort of hard to say. These guys always say, well, it's about the size of a house. It's like, oh, yeah? Okay, thanks. A bread box sometimes. The thing burns through the atmosphere and leaves a huge trail, and it's like people are holding their breath and calling the meteorologist, and everyone's freaking out every time. Oh, yeah, it's like the size of a, you know, like a bread box. All right, thanks a lot there, guy. Sorry you didn't know it was coming, too, huh? They always say that after the fact. as they're watching the trail go by, you know, and cleaning out their drawers. And I don't mean their sock drawers. Anyway, there's good work going on out there, too. Don't get me wrong, but it's fun to poke fun at the people that take themselves so seriously. Okay, what else is happening up there? All right, I didn't tell you where it was. Lovejoy. If you look toward Draco, the constellation Draco, in the northern sky after the sun goes down, you can check it out. A good night would have been tonight, and tomorrow will be just as good. And it'll be doing that for the next little while. But as always, get it while the getting's good, okay? What else? Let's see. May 15th, asteroid 5661 Hildebrandt, close to Earth. That's tomorrow. Wilhelmina Patton Fleming's 150th birthday, born in 1857. If you're interested in her story, pretty interesting one. Just, again, Google. Go to my site. Go to, I don't know, what's the place everyone goes these days? Wikipedia, right? That is a pretty interesting place, actually. My God, you want to learn? It's a good place to get a start, at least. It might not be, you know, everything you want in the depth, but man, it'll get you in the right direction, probably. I think it's a pretty interesting site. But anyway, Comet 2P Encke coming close to Earth on the 17th. Pretty close, as a matter of fact. About 50 million miles, a little bit less than that. There's a workshop on the 17th and 18th in California called the Small and Mid-Scale Exoplanet Space Mission Workshop. So some people are talking about getting the hell out of here, you know? Problem is they're not talking to you and me about it. I was telling my friend Lara, who's in the studio with me tonight, about this great Russian rocket physicist, rocket scientist. I forget his first name, Alexander Siliovsky, I think it was. But anyway, Siliovsky is his last name. And he said, certainly, the Earth is the cradle of mankind, but you cannot stay in the cradle forever. And this is one of the things that I think is happening, is that, you know, the human imagination just cannot be contained on this planet anymore, because we're going to destroy the planet and a whole lot of other stuff with it. So we've got to grab the gene swarm and get the heck out of here, at least some of us. But the way we have to do that is to get our own act together down here on the ground first, as a species, not as a nation, not as Republicans or Democrats, you know, as a species, as human beings, get our act together as a species, recognize that we are a global species, and now we're going to become an intergalactic, essentially, species. So when you're intergalactic, you can't represent the United States of America. They'll just giggle at you. You know, the best thing you can do is say the third planet out in this system here. So we're probably going to be getting on with that in a few years in the future. If it's either going to be that or it's going to be roses. So we'll have to see. But you know, I'm sort of pulling for the humankind. I think we're going to be able to pull it off. We've had a lot of problems in the past that we've overcome. Our ancestors went through a lot of difficulty and always were able to pull it off somehow. So even if we think we're lame and most of us look that way or seem that way, and, you know, maybe that's the way the world is sort of right now, doesn't mean much. The human monkey's capable of amazing things when you put it under a little bit of pressure. And the problem is there hasn't been much pressure. But we've been able to develop a lot of interesting toys in the meantime, thanks to our scientist friends. And up to now, the toys have been in the hands of a small group of, for the most part, ill-willed, selfishly intended people. But, as all things, nothing lasts forever. And lots of cats coming out of lots of sacks these days. And I love it. It's fun to watch and fun to be a part of. And I'm glad that the people out there who are paying attention are seeing it, hearing it, making it happen themselves. Just like we're doing right here tonight. All right? Okay, a few other things. Sky notes for the top of the hour here. Tomorrow night, May 15th, Venus and Saturn, about 40 degrees apart. Getting closer, though, by the end of the June month, they will pass within a half a degree of one another. Look for Saturn in the southwest, and Venus will be in the west, shining bright when the sun goes down. The 16th, similar situation up there. Mercury on the 16th, though, you can see below and to the right of Venus. And after Mercury sets a couple hours, if you look to the southeast, you'll see Jupiter rising up. Later this month, you'll be able to see all of them, Jupiter, Saturn, Venus, and Mercury, all at the same time. That's cool. All right, a few other things, but, you know, I won't mention any more. Getting to the top of the hour here. I'll play a piece of music, come back, do a few things in the news, and then I want to talk about something that's been on my mind a little bit, and we'll get on with things, okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Play another piece of music here from Sun Kill Moon. As I mentioned earlier, the disc that we're featuring all this stuff from tonight is called Ghosts of the Great Highway. And the man behind the project, Mark Kozlek. All right, thanks, Mark. Great stuff. Glenn Tipton is the name of the song. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. right, great stuff there. That song is called Glenn Tipton. And my name is Mike Hagen. And you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Just a few ticks after midnight now on the 15th of May, 2007. Thanks for sticking around, listening to the program tonight. And got a few things in the news I'll mention. And first, I should also mention on the web, kopn.org. All right. If you want to hear the live stream now or any Monday, do it on the web, whether you're here in town, out and about, or anywhere else on the planet. Okay, if we've got our act together, you'll be able to hear the show. And, of course, for the people here in town that are listening to the program, hello to all you. I know you're out there, even though you don't say much sometimes. Of course, I don't give you much chance. But anyway, all right, let's see. Musicians unlock mystery melody in Roslyn Chapel. This is this place in Scotland, right? The Templar, the Knights Templar legendary chapel of Roslyn, which is, I think they say it's short for the Rose Line. And, of course, the Rosicrucian, all the secret society stuff is all tied into this. But anyway, these couple of guys, I think a father-son team, unraveled this musical sort of conundrum that was beautifully embedded into the architecture of the church there. And it's an amazing thing. So you can even listen to it. I think somebody's like writing about it now. I think there was something written about it now, I should say, that that people were actually playing it, or someone was actually going to play it, or maybe you can actually hear it already. Maybe somebody on the in the chat room there can put up a link if you're listening to me and find that thing that I'm talking about, the Roslyn Chapel music. I think somebody actually already performed it. If people want to listen to it, maybe I'll throw the link up there. But anyway, that's going on. What else is in the news here? I told you about Frog Juice last week. I won't talk about that again. The Bastard Fairies, one of my favorite bands, even though they weren't very well received when I played them on this program. I think I'm going to play them next week again, by the way, with Laffley, with Paul Laffley, because I love them, and I dig them, and she's awesome. And anyway, Bastard Fairies, they did the funniest thing. They just took a great shot at Bill O'Reilly and just really upset him. And, of course, he was silly enough to actually mention their name on his show because he was so mad. Of course, then about a million other people went and checked out the Bastard Fairies. But anyway, great music, and at least, you know, and as always, it's just my opinion. But you can find them on the web. It's pretty easy these days. This girl's got some guts, let me tell you. I mean, she is something else. I love this girl. There's another guy named Robin Davey who's involved with the band, he and her. And she's actually a Native American girl. She's a Lakota girl. And my heart, you know, is tied to hers. And she goes by Yellow Thunder Woman. And I won't attempt a Lakota pronunciation of it right now because I haven't heard it from her. But anyway, she's a good woman and she's got guts, let me tell you. So the Bastard Fairies next week with Paul Laffley. And if you want to see something funny, Google the Bastard Fairies and Bill O'Reilly. All right. What else? Maybe I'll play that later. Kent sent me this thing, the Voice from Space broadcast. This thing that happened in November, end of November in 1977. There was an interruption to a BBC television broadcast, and whether it was a hoax or not is yet to be, you know, really proven one way or another. But trust me, in 1977, to have enough power to override the entire BBC network, it had to be a pretty serious hoax. It had to be probably a government entity or someone like that to do this. But anyway, it was essentially an ET message. It was the brothers from space. Maybe I'll play it for you later if I run out of things to do. But you can listen to that on my website if you go to the forum. It says Voice from Space broadcast November 26, 1977. And it's put up there by Kent Stedman, of course, from cyberspaceorbit.com, our great friend and wizard. This is an important one, the bee losses. You know, there's been a lot of talk of, on my show a little bit, actually, and in the news in general, about the problems with honeybees. And Lance, this wonderful guy who participates in the program and posts a lot of great stuff up on the website, he actually posted a story about these organic beekeepers. And I'm trying to load the story here on the website. But anyway, the bottom line of the story was that the people that have organic bees are not reporting losses, and there are particular reasons why they're not. It has to do with antibiotics that they feed to the bees because of these particular mites that infect them. But this came from a woman whose name is Sharon Labchuk, and she's a longtime environmental activist and an organic beekeeper that lives on Prince Edward Island. And anyway, my friend Lance is completely hooked into all this stuff. He had this thing went viral on the web a couple of days ago, but it was up on our website a week earlier because Lance is in the know with this stuff. But anyway, she says, I'm on an organic beekeeping list of about 1,000 people, mostly Americans, and no one in the organic beekeeping world, including commercial beekeepers, is reporting colony collapse on this list. The problem with the big commercial guys is that they put pesticides in their hives to fumigate for the varroa mites, and they feed antibiotics to the bees. They also haul the hives by truck all over the place to make more money with pollination services, which stresses the colonies. There's a website there that I'll actually give it out, www.bushfarms, believe it or not, how ironic, bushfarms.com/bees, bees.htm, bushfarms.com/bees.htm. I'll actually grab this here and throw it up in the chat real fast. At any rate, the organic people are saying that they're not having any problems. Listen to this. She goes on to say, and you can read this for yourself if you go to the forum, but says, most of us beekeepers are fighting with the varroa mites. I'm happy to say my biggest problems are things like trying to get nukes through the winter and coming up with hives that won't hurt my back from lifting or better ways to feed the bees. This change from fighting the mites is mostly because I've gone to natural-sized cells. In case you weren't aware, and I wasn't for a long time, the foundation in common usage results in much larger bees than what you would find in a natural hive. I've measured sections of natural worker brood comb that are 4.6 millimeters in diameter, and what most people use for worker brood these days in the foundation is 5.4 millimeters. If you translate that into three dimensions instead of one, it produces a bee that is about half as large, again, as is natural. By letting the bees build natural-sized cells, I have virtually eliminated the varroa and tracheal mite problems. One cause of this is a shorter capping time by one day, and shorter post-capping times by one day. This means less varroa get in the cells and less varroa reproduce in the cells. So she goes on, but at any rate, as always, doing things the natural way is usually the best way to do it. Nature has figured things out long before the GMO beekeeper showed up on the scene, and they might take a tip, like Sharon Labchuk, doing great work. All right, thanks to Lance for getting that to us, all right? What else here in the news? NASA discovers twilight zone of new particles in the air. So this is another variable that all the climate change people are going to have to add to their next model. You know, the furious modeling attempt of everyone to try to come up with a good model. A while back, luckily science got a little bit of humility and decided, well, we don't know exactly what's going on, but we have good models. And so what we're going to do is just make our models better and better and better. Well, you know, in some cases the models are good. In some cases the models aren't so good. In the case of, you know, global climate change, man, the model's a tough one because there are lots of variables for sure. Telluric currents. I mean, who the hell even knows? Most people don't even know what the hell we're talking about, you know? And everyone's a specialist in this, that, or the other thing, but very few people are looking at the whole situation. I mean, it's as dynamic a situation as exists. I mean, certainly the only situation that we know exists, and it is the ultimate in, you know, dynamics and chaos, the way the world works. So, anyway, new particles in the air discovered by NASA. They call it a twilight zone. It was actually they were actually just blown away by it, freaked them out. Speaking of that, there's a bunch of gigantic peaks that have been identified with new technology under the glaciers of Antarctica. And in New Scientist, by the way, which is a great magazine, I don't say that about many, but they call it a geological impossibility, what they're seeing there. So once again, you know, proof everywhere about how little we know about our own planet. So as always, you know, get to know yourself, get to know your own planet. Do that first before you go outward and, you know, tell everybody else the way the rest of the universe is. So, oh man, it's like 12:15. I was hoping to get into this a little bit earlier, but I need to get some water. And how many songs do I have left? I have enough to get through the show for sure. All right, I'm going to play another song from Sun Kill Moon. This one is for my lovely Ashley, the mother of my beautiful children. She's probably waking up just about now, having to feed my son, Lucas, my other boy, Alistair, hopefully sleeping tight. And anyway, for my family, I love you all so much. And all my friends, here you go. This is Sun Kill Moon. This song is called Carry Me, Ohio. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Song.
Called Carry Me Ohio, Sun Kill Moon, Ghosts of the Great Highway, and my name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. Okay, so where am I here? Okay, a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned something about the therapeutic use of psychedelics, psilocybin in particular. That's the one I'm most familiar with. But anyway, someone wrote and asked me if I would follow up on it. And tonight we have some time, and it's a subject that I think deserves a reasonable amount of time. So I'm going to do that tonight. I'm going to do it now, okay? There are a number of people around town. I won't say their names. I know a couple of actually really good people in psychiatry and or psychology here in the Columbia area at the university. And you know, sometimes I see people out in a social situation and we have a chance to talk sort of, you know, more freely than we might in an academic environment. But anyway, I have asked a number of them. We were talking about drugs used in psychiatry, frankly, and I asked about, you know, what their positions on the psychedelic plants were. And we had sort of short discussions about it because, frankly, they weren't that familiar with the stuff. I mean, there were people, you know, a couple of them knew that there had been research done in the 60s and in the 70s, but had pretty much discounted it. And some of the newer stuff that has happened in the last year, year and a half or so, I don't think has quite made it on the radar the way I hoped it would. But anyway, people, and this isn't to talk down, I mean, people certainly interested in it. The two acquaintances of mine were very interested and wanted to learn more, and I'm sure that they went out and I'm sure that they're doing that. But at any rate, you know, barbiturates is what is mostly prescribed. And I was sort of stunned when I found that out. It's sort of scary because, I don't know, that those drugs, in my opinion, are not ones that are helpful. So I pointed out the Hopkins report and all that stuff, and anyway, it's been a year or so since the Johns Hopkins report came out. I think it was June or July of last year. And, of course, I mean the amazing paper that Rollin Griffiths and the other people there at Johns Hopkins, and who was on our program here? I can't believe I forget his name, but Dennis's partner, one of Dennis's partners there at Hefter. Dave Nichols. And anyway, lots of other people there at Johns Hopkins that did an amazing, rigorous, and pretty much foolproof study on psilocybin and released their findings last year. And it was a wonderful report, well-documented and very thorough and just well done. And after that, some other people have picked it up. There's work going on, I think, at UCLA again, a paper from Harvard, even the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, sort of getting hip. Now, of course, they insist that it must be under the supervision of a doctor, these things that we're talking about. But, you know, they're always going to tell you that, though. You know, the truth is, in my opinion, before anybody practices, you know, psychiatry or psychology, they should be doing these things themselves. But I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on here, though. But, you know, the vision plants do the work for the most part, not the doctor. And in many cases, you know, the doctor, like the shaman, really doesn't understand how the plants do what they do. They address everyone as an individual. And, you know, it's different from person to person. And after, you know, a long time of trying to study these things, which are essentially neurotransmitters, the ones that I'm talking about tonight, you know, there's still a whole lot of question marks. So anyway, we have these reports and papers, Johns Hopkins, Harvard, et cetera, decades of research and a new knowledge and understanding of the techniques of archaic shamanism. And frankly, no one around here is talking about it. No articles in any of the papers, nothing in the medical journals. I've looked at everything I can find in Mizzou's psych department and that sort of thing. And maybe there are people that are doing this stuff. I hope so. If you are, man, get in touch with me. I'd love to help you move the work forward. And if there are people out there listening that are in psychiatry or psychology, I encourage you to, you know, listen to this and share it with your professors and whoever else you think it might benefit. But it's stuff that I have felt is important and has made a difference in my own personal life, and I'd like to share it with other people. That's my primary sort of agenda, nothing other than that. You know, take it for what it's worth. I'm not trying to push anything on anyone. I'm just going to give you my opinion and tell you that it's worked well for me. All right? Let's see if we can get some other people talking about it, maybe. That's my sort of goal tonight. All right? Okay. The shamanic use of plants. My involvement, my experience with shamanic technique and the associated plants, primarily the mushroom for me, psilocybin mushroom, Stropharia cubensis, psilocybe cubensis, psilocybe, some people call it. It is one of a deepening learning over the course of a long time, and it remains useful to me because it always changes, and no matter how I change, it always somehow integrates itself with me, and always more completely, and somehow fits into my own life and helps me in, you know, the managing of reality in general, whatever that means. So for me, the word shamanism is sort of a personal metaphor. It's not a religion. It's more like a set of styles or techniques, you know, for how to do something. But it's not only a way of being a person in the world, you know, but it's also a metaphor for the species. You know, all this stuff is fractal. And it's sort of a metaphor for the historical adventure of our species, of human beings. So I do want to talk about it for a little while here as an advocate. I want to make it seem indispensable to living a good life of intelligence and understanding and compassion. I want to try to make people see that without shamanism, being human itself loses a great part of its potential and in fact is in crisis. And I'd argue that because humanness is rooted in shamanism, our archaic ancestors, it is a humanness that is rooted in a complicated and long-term symbiotic relationship with a number of plants and chemicals that those plants produce and then move into their environments. And I'm going to argue that people without plants are potentially people in a state of neurosis, a state of existential need and want. And that a big part of the whole Western crisis, the cultural crisis, the dilemma that we find ourselves now smack in the middle of, is the sense of abandonment that followed the breaking off of these relationships with the plants, the visionary plants in particular, and the natural world in general, which accompanied the rise of Western monotheism and the rise of modern society and the whole business. So I want to go back to origins for a minute, and I'm going to borrow from Terence. Because this is where a really good argument can be made, in my opinion, the time we're living through, and this weird movement that we're all a part of, the so-called New Age or the Aquarian Age or whatever it is, you know, the new millennium, the archaic revival, as Terence liked to call it, whatever, you know. The reason Terence called it the archaic revival is because it is a revivification of the models and algorithms of archaic shamanism. The shaman then becomes the center of the mandala. Shamanism was the ultimate expression of humanness in the High Neolithic. So we should talk about what it was. You know, the profession of shamanism. Well, first of all, it's about exploring the edges of cognition, exploring the edges of what the mind can handle, pushing away boundaries, all boundaries, in particular boundaries of language and convention, boundaries of culture, and what culture, regardless of what the culture is, whatever we're talking about, what any culture insists about what we can say or symbolize or conceive or communicate. So it's a weird thing that's happening with us. You know, why should one species, out of all of those available in the biosphere, get to some kind of mega adaptability in which we have this weird time compression, which happens in a biological sense, and actually creates what we call history. In other words, a tremendous quickening was initiated, and the accompanying levels of change, which we are now living in, this hyper explosion. And the question, you know, I don't know, is it as the religions insist that divine intervention is what brought about us, our uniqueness? Or are we not that unique? You know, is it like the 19th century people thought, you know, that incremental change can eventually catalyze and bring on new states of higher order, more complex, including self-reflection, consciousness, and that somehow this is no more than just an advancement of, you know, the previous forms of nature? Well, I don't know. I think, in my opinion, it's a combination of both of these things. It's a bit of the divine and a bit of the Darwinian model. So let's talk about the evolutionary thing for a second, or at least one evolutionary model. And this is Terence's idea that I want to talk about. A good night to talk about Terence's ideas. As always, I'm wearing his shirt. So anyway, sort of a derogatory term that's been associated with Terence's theory, which is an actual, you know, legitimate scientific theory that's talked about quite a bit these days in evolutionary biology. But it sort of got tagged with the name the stoned ape theory. It's sort of a derogatory name, like I said, but it's actually an elegant and well-thought-out theory. Anyhow, it pretty much goes like this, okay? What evolutionary biologists had for a long time missed with regard to human emergence out of the primate situation, and still to a certain extent, is the mutagenic effects of foods. The fact that a fruit-eating monkey living in an arboreal rainforest setting because of a situation of changing climate, you know, as we're seeing today, the climate does change, and it always has. The Earth is a living, breathing, dynamic entity, and, you know, she changes. But at any rate, there was a spreading dryness that moved out into the grasslands and, you know, sort of forced our primate ancestors out onto the grasslands to evolve into a pack-hunting animal with an omnivorous diet. Went from a fruit-eating diet to an omnivorous diet. And, you know, omnivores, by their pure nature, will try many different foods. And many of these different foods present mutagenic influences. And I mean this in a chemical sense. You know, a mutagenic influence might interfere with the correct copying of proteins. It might interfere with hormonal cycles, menstruation, lactation. Who knows? It can even affect mentation, cognition, psychoactive compounds in the food chain, which affect the mind. And it's interesting to me, at least, that as humans transform themselves into omnivores, pack hunters, we begin to see the first stirrings of self-reflection. We begin to see the fire pits and, you know, the chipped flint tools and some of the ceremonial stuff that's quite old. And what Terence thought all this said, and he outlines all this in great detail in a book called Food of the Gods, and I encourage everyone to read it. Terence argued that there was a unique confluence of events and factors which were capable of bringing on this particular change, literally an ontological change, which had previously been the animal primate mind. And what T suggested was that this factor was psychoactive plants in the environment, specifically plants in the grassland environment in which human hunting and gathering, human pastoralism, developed, you know, a million, give or take, how many years, a million or so years ago. Now, the plant would have to grow in Africa. It would have to grow on the grasslands and not be exclusively, at least, not be a deep forest variety, because it appears that the changes were being undergone on the grasslands. And so it must be something that made itself easily available and easily discoverable out there on the plains. So what Terence had thought was that one of the only plants that satisfied these criteria are mushrooms of the psilocybin-containing sort. And from there, it's not difficult to see then that the presence of a compound, the presence of a compound like psilocybin in the diet, it's not difficult to see how that could set the stage for the brain and the mind and for a number of changes to occur within those things. Psilocybin in low doses increases what they call visual acuity. There's this guy named Roland Fischer. I think I've told the story before on the air. This Viennese hardcore German scientist who actually experimented with very, very low doses of psilocybin and then did visual acuity tests with college students, I think. And sorry, I got to wet my whistle there. But what Roland Fischer said, and he actually had a conversation with Terence McKenna about this, and Terence talked about it, that Roland Fischer proved to himself and everybody else that small doses of psilocybin, levels that you couldn't even detect, in other words, you wouldn't even know that you took the stuff, actually increase visual acuity, edge detection, this sort of thing. Makes your eyes better. It's the equivalent of putting on chemical binoculars. And Roland Fischer actually said to Terence, he said, "I think it's amazing. It's a case in which the person is actually more aware of reality on the drug than off the drug." And Terence sort of like, "Yeah, uh-huh." But I don't think Roland Fischer quite got what he was actually saying. But at any rate, at low doses, psilocybin does increase visual acuity. And it's easy to see then that in a pack hunting species, in a new environment, undergoing tremendous evolutionary pressure, better vision would be a plus. You know, from a purely scientific zoological perspective, animals that include these substances in their diets will have a more successful reproductive strategy. The counterpoint, of course, is that animals that do not include these compounds will be mitigated against and, eventually will leave the scene. And in this manner, so suggested our friend Terence McKenna, and an idea that has now caught on with mainstream anthropologists and evolutionary biologists, is how self-reflection in the human monkey came to be through a steady bootstrapping process. And, you know, this isn't something that is really taking the place and throwing off any other evolutionary theories. It's just sort of another one out there. It's a mystery of how we became who we are and how we are. And Terence is a person who developed a theory and put it out there among other theories, you know, to stand and be criticized or whatever and make of it what you will. All right? But it really is a mystery, and there are still major questions about what happened, and this was Terence's best guess about what he thought. And I'm someone who, frankly, goes along with most of this. And I say it because of experiences that I've had, not because of books that I've read, although they certainly helped me get there. At any rate, to get from visual acuity to self-reflection, this is how it may have happened. Now, some people say, no, it was the human arm, the development of being the throwing arm, and this ability to throw a rock. You know, I mean, you can wing the ability of a pitcher in baseball to throw a ball 60 feet at that speed and with that accuracy. No other animal can come near doing anything like that in a physical sense. And so many people say, well, no, this is what separated us out. But if you think about it closely, even that requires good hand-eye coordination. So this theory does not really bust heads with that idea. It could actually help, you know. You're better throwing arm, you have better eyes, etc. So at any rate, let's see. This is, you know, maybe how it happened. Low doses, increased visual acuity, edge detection, night vision. Higher doses, a little bit higher, among other things, bring on heightened interest in sex, erotic activity. And higher doses even so put one in contact with who knows what, this mystery that everyone is talking about. Well, maybe not everyone is, but I am. And it's just, you know, the most astounding thing that I can't stop talking about it. A mystery that exists in and beyond the human psyche and which remains as mysterious today as it must have to our ancestors, our ancient ancestors on the African plains. Now, it is a mystery that is brought on by a symbiotic relationship with another species. And the content of the mystery is such that, you know, don't kid yourselves. The content of this thing exposes pretty much every ideology, positivism, humanism, scientism, religionism, modernism, rationalism. It's all just smoking into the wind. Because the depth of this mystery that has called us out of the animal phylogeny is completely impenetrable to modern analysis, no matter what anybody tells you. That's why for so long you couldn't even discuss this in academic circles. And to this day it remains pretty obscure and fringy. But there are people doing it now in big-time institutions. So, you know, if Johns Hopkins is doing it, Harvard's doing it, the people in California are doing it, well, you know, we're cutting edge, right? We're progressive here. We need to be talking about it here too. So this is the early idea. As the symbiotic relationship between the human monkey, the mushrooms, and the cattle on which the humans hunted and on whose dung the mushrooms grew, as pastoralism and this hunting gathering thing developed and a domestic relationship with these animals and plants settled in, it reinforced itself. Language arose. The religion of the goddess variety developed. And the connection between the cow and the goddess was there at the beginning. There's evidence of this very early on. You might recall the work of Rian Eisler and the conversation that we had last year. No question about it. The connection between the cow and the goddess is right there. And interestingly, as an aside, language may have been more the domain of women in the early developmental days. And this may have been just because men were primarily involved in the business of hunting. And, you know, great value is placed on silence and stealth in a hunting environment. And men, you know, perhaps would have been more responsible for the development of signing and body talking and this sort of thing, but women were engaged as gatherers of plants primarily. And in this hunter-gatherer situation, and any botanist will tell you this, you know, it involves an extensive language so that the minutiae, you know, the little differences in grains and insects and all kinds of things need to be described linguistically and defined that way. Even today, listen to guys like Dennis talk. They love to say things like Banisteriopsis copy trifoliated globulosed or something, you know. On and on for lines. They're great at it. And so women would have been deeply involved in this identification process of the plants and, you know, and the critters as well. And probably would have developed words to signify them. Hence language. And in a weird way, you can see over and over again through history, though, how all these advances outsmart themselves. Language is what makes me think of this, because in our own situation, in the modern world, like it is, but in the situation we're describing here, the evolving hunter-gatherer ancestor situation, the development and advancement of language and signification, what it did, it led to a terrible discovery. Well, that's probably a bad way to put it, because it gives history a bad rap. But the outsmart was agriculture, because they figured out rather than to keep this ongoing record of shifting information on seasonal plants distributed here and there all randomly or by the whims of the wind and Mother Nature, that they could concentrate on a small number of plants, learn everything about those plants, and, you know, the trick was pulled. The retreat was on. Dualism takes its place, and there becomes the distinction of things which are domesticated, things of the hearth, and those things from the Ausland, from the unknown, beyond the pale, the unspeakable stuff. You know, there was this anthropologist, Weston Labarra, who actually did a lot of his work in ethnobotany. But anyhow, I think he suggested that psychedelic plants couldn't be used by agricultural societies because their regular use would make it real difficult to get up at dawn and work the fields. So suddenly you see with agriculture the gods become the gods of the corn and the wheat gods and the gods of domesticity and labor and this type of thing. And as the agricultural meme takes a greater hold, then you get production and surplus. Surplus leads to trade. No one is moving around much anymore, so you get cities, or at least you know, groups of people living in one place. Again, surplus means you got to protect it. If you have extra and you're not moving, you have to protect it, so you get standing armies, and then the whole game is on. And at the same time, we see the beginnings of the break of this millennia-old symbiotic relationship of humankind with the natural world, with nature. The separation from nature begins. And this is not meant as a metaphor. I mean to say that the root cause of the great majority of challenges and problems that modernity face is a disruption of the symbiotic relationship between ourselves and the plants with which we used to partner, and that only a restoration of this in some way, some shape or form, somehow, it's the only thing that will deliver us back into our full potential and our birthright as human beings. So, what time is it? Well, we got a few minutes. Let me talk more about this symbiotic relationship that I keep talking about was. What was the effect of this use of psychedelic plants upon language? What did it do to language-using thinking monkeys? Well, one of the theories is that it acted as a feminizing hormone, or a pheromone of some sort. In other words, regular exposure to the ecstatic mystery, the tremendous mystery brought forth by the mushroom, it continuously dissolved that portion of the psyche that we recognize as the male ego. And this doesn't mean that it only works on men. It means that wherever the ego begins to arise within the population, men or women, the psycholytic effects of the mushroom and the undeniable fact of the mystery, the tremendum, the undeniable fact of those things tended to dissolve the individual ego. So then the development of language combined with agriculture and moving off into specialization away from nature, all this set up the foundations for the current social, cultural, environmental crisis we face today, I think. It's only in the West that we get this unwavering concentration on monotheistic ideals and eternally attempt to work out the details and implications of what is basically a pathological personality complex, the one of this deity, this God, the omnipotent, omnipresent, all-knowing, but wrathful male God. No one I want to invite to my solstice celebration, if you know what I mean. And it's really interesting that Western monotheism is the only representation of deities that I know of, and Joe Campbell taught me this, in which there is virtually zero association and involvement of women. Not at any point in the myth does the God of Western civilization have anything to do with women. And the presence of the Sophia and the Black Madonna and all this have only been tolerated as heresies in the Western tradition. And it's the same tradition that has been the most uninterrupted with regard to this period of a break with nature, the separation from the vegetable world and the gnosis, the knowledge available and present there. So we have essentially worked our way into an extended state of neurosis because of the loss of a direct link to the unconscious mind, the loss of the link to the psyche, and we have hence fallen prey to priestcraft of every imaginable sort. A similar thing which we can look at happened for the Indo-European peoples that went east instead of west. I mean, look at the historical religious traditions of Indian civilization. It's the whole story of a male-dominated hierarchical system bent on the maintenance of order, status quo. And this occurred after the loss of the secret, soma. Don't forget about it. That's what they talked about there, the secret soma, which was some sort of a portal to another kind of gnosis, again provided by plants. There are some that even believe that soma was a mushroom. Blake, I think, was one of those. But anyway, what kind of options are available to people who believe these things? I want to talk about some of the plants specifically, you know, that do this stuff. Of course, we have the psilocybin mushroom. This is the complex that was rediscovered by Gordon and Valentina Wasson, the magic mushroom of central Mexico, which most certainly had a place in the Maya and Toltec and Olmec civilizations. If you've heard the conversations we've had with John Major Jenkins, you'll be very interested in that background. And John's brilliant, and I love him, and he's doing great work. Then you have the wide range, you know, the Stropharia cubensis, the Psilocybe cubensis. It goes from Thailand, but all through the tropics, and distributed all over this planet. And by the way, for those interested in chemistry, with the exception of mescaline, peyote, all of these visionary plants sanctioned by the shamans, at least, the ones that I know of, fall into the indole group. This is a pretty narrow group of alkaloids, a narrow family of compounds, all the mushrooms, the morning glory complex, the iboga, the African iboga, and then the short-acting tryptamines, DMT, and the beta-carbolines. The beta-carbolines are hallucinatory by themselves, but at dose levels that are not comforting, and they're most often used as a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, MAO inhibitors, to extend the effect of DMT or other tryptamines in ayahuasca, for example. You know, they mix the leaves and the two plants, the Banisteriopsis plant with the Secotria viridis plant, and I forget which one of the two, but one of them has the, you know, beta carbolene in it that that basically eliminates the problem in the gut of the destruction of DMT, and it can make it up to the brain. But at any rate, it's a pretty narrow group of chemicals, compounds, neurotransmitters, DMT found in human metabolism, normal human metabolism, you, me, the judge is trying to put you in jail for it, everybody's carrying. People who listen to my show and who know me know that I never talk, or rarely at least, talk about synthetic compounds. This is because I think that it's critical to keep the visionary plant compounds separate from the whole debate, the whole other discussion of the drug war and the drug problem and all this stuff. That's a whole other ball of wax, which is involved with immense amounts of money and the fates of nations, you know, and corrupt intelligence organizations and gangs and cabals of who knows what sort. The organic, visionary stuff, that's the stuff I'm talking about. I think they're different. And the fact that they have been used successfully and with great effect for millennia by shamanic cultures is the first stamp of approval that I think we need to be looking for. If these things have been used for thousands of years, we can be pretty confident that they don't cause cancer or stillborn babies or, you know, fetal malformation or, you know, cause you to get cavities in your dentures or, you know, grow boobs on your backside. There are many other substances that could have been chosen that were available, you know, for human use in our past. So there's a long, drawn-out trial and error selectivity process that's been able to be applied over time. So let's see. One thing I want to talk about before we take a break, and then I'll come back to this stuff, but we should talk about substances that are the least taxing and damaging on the body, on the human biological system and the brain, etc. The compounds that leave real small footprints after the fact. And the indoles that we're talking about here are amazing in this case because they are already present, as I mentioned, in some shape or form in the brain. So, one way to determine how long a relationship has existed between human beings and a certain species of plant is to look at how benign or how damaging the compounds contained in the plant might be when they are introduced to human metabolism. I mean, if you eat some plant and 3 days later you still need to, you know, have a hot shower and your eyes are still blurred, well, this is a compound that is not benign, and it's a compound that you probably shouldn't be messing with, and there's not a smooth fit between it and human physiology, whatever it is, wherever it comes from. Now, this is another reason why the tryptamine complexes are so interesting, because, first of all, they leave no trace pretty shortly after you use them. The body knows exactly what to do with these things, in other words. After an ayahuasca experience or a deep mushroom experience, it is not unusual for a person to feel wonderful, refreshed, cleansed, etc. Now, if you compare that to a morning after beer, tequila, and chartreuse, you know, well, there's another good argument for why the mushroom complex was probably involved in human evolution, because these things have a remarkable similarity to human neurotransmitters. The entire human nervous system, of course, including the brain, runs on 5-hydroxytryptamine. That's serotonin. I mean, my gosh, DMT is the most powerful of all of these hallucinogens, and it clears the system in minutes. This argues for a really long history of relationship between humans and these compounds, these plants. All right, okay, let's take a break. It's top of the hour. Come back. We'll talk a little bit about technique and how you're supposed to do this stuff. And in the meantime, we'll listen to Lily and Parrots, Sun Kill Moon. This is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Parrots from Ghost of the Great Highway. That's Sun Kill Moon, Mark Kozelek and his gang. And thanks for making great music. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, just about 5 minutes after 1 a.m., now on the 15th of May, 2007. Okay, let's talk about technique. How do you get the maximum benefit? All right, a tough one. This is a tough one. It's like Aldous Huxley said, kind of a gratuitous grace. All the conditions for success can be present, but one can still fail. In a way, I'm reluctant to talk about this because it's personal, but a good starting place is basically to sit down, be quiet, and pay attention. Side notes, perhaps, on an empty stomach, alone in a dark room, or in nature with an open mind and an open heart and good intention. It's kind of difficult to discuss this stuff because of language. The more I talk about this stuff in public to other people, I realize that the most difficult thing to convey is what we're actually talking about. I mean, everybody has some sort of backdrop and perception of their own drug experiences, but they have a tough time realizing that theirs is different from everybody else's. You know, drugs range from all over the place. They have effects that are as diverse as the people who use them. But what is essential to get across with regard to the visionary plants is the fact of the mystery, the reality of the presence of this other intelligence. And this is so important to this particular discussion because we're talking about people interested in these things for psychiatric and psychological reasons and for those purposes. And so, you know, with so many other situations we face as human beings right now, and I say this all the time, but it's a situation in which we are not in need of searching for the answer. It's a situation of facing and accepting the answer. The answer has been found. It's just that the answer is one that is on the wrong side of the fence of cultural toleration and this sort of thing. So we get forced into a corner doing this strange little go-go dance. I mean, everybody knows that the psychedelic plants are the most powerful instrument for the study of the mind conceivable. And yet still, we have many people at the top levels of institutions and universities and what have you who fiddle-faddle with all kinds of silliness while they ignore the fact that the tool has been placed in our hands. It's very similar to the 16th century when the telescope was invented. We have shown now that we are not large enough to take the tool into our own hands without a cultural and intellectual metamorphosis and transformation. And I think it has to begin in psychology and psychiatry by acknowledging that if what we are involved in, this changing of ages that we all sense, if it is an archaic revival, then we can create a caring, sensitive, compassionate, ecologically stable, re-feminized world by returning to these very old models and combining them with what we know now. The only way we'll ever be able to wield the technology that we're developing is with some wisdom, you know? And the only way we get the wisdom at this point, and in the short time frame that we have, I think, is through these plants. But by returning to these old models, I think it's the only way to do it. It isn't going to be possible to do it on the tail of political positioning and rap alone. It requires the experience, an experience that shakes you to your roots and is so real that it cannot be denied, an experience that can then be generalized, perhaps, and talked about, debated, openly parsed out, whatever. But it is imperative, I think, that we recognize the depth of our dilemma and the real options we have for getting ourselves out, whether these options are currently socially acceptable or not. And the fact that we actually know what the options are, yet refuse to exercise and ignore them, well, that means the lights are on but nobody's home. What did Roger Waters say? Everyone's gone fishing. We're a quart low, dealing with half a deck, whatever. As long as we tolerate the priests of government and religion and science, and tolerate that they can somehow dictate where human curiosity and imagination and consciousness can legitimately focus its attention and where it can't. It's essentially a ridiculous situation. It's a civil and human rights issue. Because what we're talking about is the repression of a religious sensibility and expression. I take that back. What we're talking about is the religious sensibility, the religious expression. Not some con game spun out by beady-eyed pedophiles and power mongers and control freaks, but a religious experience based on the symbiotic relationship that was in place between our species and these visionary plant species at least 50,000 years before the advent of history, before the advent of writing, organized religion, priestcraft, propaganda, all this stuff. So this is a call to recover and redeem a birthright, regardless of how uncomfortable that may make people. A call to realize that life lived in the absence of the psychedelic mystery, life lived without having these experiences that all of our ancestors recognized as a foundation of life and the basis of primordial shamanism. Anything else is a life of infantilism, triviality, imprisonment of a sort. It's a life that is denied, a life enslaved to the ego, and afraid of disillusionment. The mystery, the thing that Blake called the mama matrix most mysterious, which is actually all around us and extends, it seems, forever, inside and out, and where our future history actually probably lies. Now, this is the other thing. It's pretty clear now. Of all the things that are being developed in information technology, medical technology, physics, pharmacology, relational things, you know, the way people interface, all of them are lining up to bring forward a world that is going to be truly demonic or truly angelic. And let me tell you, the folks on the demonic side of the track are fully aware of this and moving full tilt forward to implement their agendas and plans to capture every human being on this planet and reduce them to a 100% compliant consumer, living in some gray, furnished, fascist world that won't even raise a hair. So what are we supposed to do? The shamanic answer, I think, is to push the art pedal. Again, what Terrence suggested, push the art pedal to the metal, through the floorboard. This is actually, in fact, another primary function of shamans, and a function that is tremendously synergized and catalyzed by the plants, by the mushroom, by psilocybin, DMT, these things. We talked earlier about how these compounds were pheromones, which dissolve the masculine ego, but they're also pheromones that synergize and turbocharge imagination and creative sensibilities and so forth and so on. I mean, I really do believe that I wouldn't do this, you know? I wouldn't do this. But I really do believe that the only way out of this trap that we are firmly entrenched in, the trap of post-industrial materialist, male-dominated, politically manipulated, drug-running, arms-dealing, planet-raping, urban technocracy, the only way out is the forward escape. The pedal to the metal blaze right up the middle, through and beyond the nonsense, brush it aside. The way to do that is a tremendous expansion of art and creativity. You know, at the root of shamanism is healing. To heal and to help, my grandfather Wallace always told me, to heal and to help. The art aspect kind of gets lost in that definition. But when we're talking about healing, a healing that must take place on a planetary level, then I think the art aspect of shamanism can take its place, center stage, man. Because what the art-making function is all about is the generating of a new guiding image for and about ourselves, a new set of stories and myths. And this is why it relates so fundamentally to psychology. We need a new set of paradigmatic images to take us through the birth canal of history that we can feel resisting us and resisting the change into this more expansive, loving, more human, more compassionate dimension, which is insisting on being born. And so in terms of politics, reform of the institution of psychology, in terms of understanding history and our future, in terms of our own obligations as individuals, all these things, they are all signposts that point us back to shamanism as the model on which we can base a new paradigm, to take its techniques seriously, even those which go against the divinely conceived rules and regs of constipated ordination. Because if we don't, we are not playing with all our cards. You know, years ago, before the term psychedelics was decided upon as the descriptive word for these things, before that whole thing came, these substances, they were called consciousness-expanding agents. They were simply given a phenomenological description. And I really think this is a wonderful way to describe them. I mean, think about what is happening on this planet. Think about the dilemmas we face. The whole list of them. War, terror, destruction, disconnection with nature, the resulting environmental degradation, collapse maybe, discompassion, political buffoonery, ignorance and denial of our own past, our own ancestors, technology seemingly on a trip all its own with no allegiance to anything or anyone, all these things, so much more. Think about them. Now, if the expansion of consciousness does not play a significant role in the future of our species and this planet, well, what kind of a future is it going to be? I mean, are we going to get stupider? Are we going to become more animal-like, more brutal? If that's the case, then our species is not long for this game. So in my mind, when you consider it clearly, the psychedelic position is most fundamentally threatening because it is an anti-drug position. I've spoken about this before in the words of our fearful leader. Make no mistake about it. The issue is drugs. How drugged shall you be? Or maybe a better way to look at it is like this. How conscious shall you be? And who shall be conscious? And who shall be unconscious? Here's a good example. A good example, I think, to sort of expose what I'm talking about with regard to consciousness and the levels of this stuff. Imagine if the Japanese had won World War II and taken over the country and introduced an insidious drug that caused the average person to sit for 5 hours a day exposed to and consuming enemy propaganda. This is exactly what happened. It really happened. But the Japanese did do it. They sort of helped out, I guess, Sony and all of them. But we did it to ourselves with the television. 5 hours a day on average in this country, American people, 5 hours a day on average. That means there are folks out there that are watching a whole lot more than that. I know people that are fired up on it all the time. They got a television in every room, sleep with it on, etc. So they got plenty of time racked up for the lot of us. You see, what we need is a more complete and clear definition, an operational definition, and an awareness of what a drug really is. What do we mean when we say drug? To me, to my mind, a drug is something that causes unexamined, obsessive, habitual behavior. You don't examine your behavior, you just do it. You do it obsessively. You let nothing get in the way of it. This is the kind of life we're being sold on every level. To watch, to consume, to buy. You can look at oil as another great example. Talk about an addiction. Talk about a drug. My God, whomever the unlucky folks are that have this stuff, you know, I feel sorry for anyone who's got it. It goes like this. You got it. We want it. We're willing to pay for it. But if you don't play pretty much by our rules, we're perfectly happy to take it. This is addiction on a national scale, on a global scale. Now, the psychedelic thing is off in this corner, never mentioned. and yet it represents the only reasonable counteraction toward a tendency to just place everybody in some designer state of semi-consciousness. And it's not even their own design. The design of Wall Street or Madison Avenue or the Pentagon or whatever, you know. Not agendas that are good for the individual. And this is actually happening. I mean, it's only a matter of how tightly you want to draw the metaphor, you know. I come and go from Chicago and Denver a lot. When you do this from the air, you can see if you look down on the cities, you see all these modularly designed neighborhoods, their little cul-de-sacs and their matching mailboxes, and they look like printed circuits. You ever see that movie, Koyaanisqatsi, the Hopi word? My God, it's exactly what it reminds me of. They all have their particular and identical modules placed this way and that way. And you can see that as long as the TV guide keeps coming and the next big game continues to be broadcast, that these are all just interchangeable parts. And that whir you're hearing is Eli Whitney spinning in his grave. And this is the nightmarish scenario that McLuhan and Philip K. Dick and Orwell and Huxley and all these guys saw. The creation of the public, which has no history, no future, lives in a never-ending gray moment created by credit, which ties and binds them, without hope, to a fascist system which can never be criticized. And this is the ultimate consequence of having broken off this symbiotic relationship with the plant, feminine, maternal mama matrix of the planet. This is what ended partnership. This is what destroyed balance, caused the bloody backslide of history. This is what causes the nostalgia for paradise, because we were there one time. But see, now we can examine all the options available and put in place archaic options that will restore this balance. And to the great credit of men and women like Gordon and Valentina Wasson, Richard Allen Schulte, Albert Hoffman, Sasha and Ann Shulgin, Terrence and Dennis, Tim, a lot of other people. We now have in our hands the tools with which to do this. The tools to restore the balance. We need simply recognize that we have the answers and implement them with the tools that we've been given. But for psychology and psychiatry, man, there had better not be another Nuremberg. Because way too few folks have stood up for this. As scientists and doctors, you know, for 40 years, we've been contented to use animals as models for human behavior. What that does is effectively regard humans as laboratory rats. They actually call it that. They actually have a term for it. They call it ratomorphism. And this has been propped up for a long time when a lot of people knew that it wasn't true. And this is still the case today. And if you're in these fields and listening to this, you know, feeling guilty, I hope you are. No, not really. I don't want anyone to feel guilty. What I'd like is for people to recognize this stuff and to start to talk about it and investigate it, and I think it's imperative. The cultural crisis grows ever more intense. The stakes are rising every day. If there were ever a time to talk about these things, clarify these issues, now is the time. You know, I don't have to tell you there's a major, an ongoing attack on the Bill of Rights. In the guise of the drug war and the terror war and who knows whatever wars they got going. But the drug war, you know, and the drug issue is one that is not going to go away. 20 years ago, Reagan and the first George Bush told us that drugs were in the living room. You know what? They were right. It is here. They are here. And if we don't get smart with our rhetoric and our education and our usage of them, they will cause us great difficulty. So the quality of rhetoric coming from the therapists, coming from psychologists, coming from psychoanalysts, it's going to have to radically improve, or we are going to suffer the consequences of this ignorance. And the professionals, in my opinion, need to have these experiences. It's the only way they can see what the full spectrum of human experience can be. To see what their patients are actually experiencing, perhaps. And it is astounding what that spectrum allows. It's sort of whatever you can take. Terrence used to tell the story of a friend of his that said, you know, every time I do it, I see if I can take more. I want to see if I can take more. And he didn't mean by dosage, by taking, you know, any more of the substance. He meant taking more of the experience. How much could he handle? Because it can always raise the bar. And it is astonishing. But the psychedelic issue is a civil rights issue. You know, the reason women weren't giving the vote in the 19th century was, well, they gave one simple reason. The same reason that the king could not give up the divine right. It would ruin society. Chaos would result. That's why we're told that, you know, certain drugs cannot be legalized, because society would disintegrate. This is ludicrous. Most cultures have always operated in the presence of various habits based on plants. All of history, as a matter of fact, can be related as a series of relationships made and broken with plants. Think about tobacco and mercantilism, coffee. Think about coffee and the modern office worker. I've talked about that before on the air, but, you know, that's a remarkable one. Think about the way Britain used opium policy to manipulate, you know, the Far East and rule China. Or the way the CIA introduced heroin into the ghettos of America, our own country, in the 60s to shut down, you know, black people from dissenting and, you know, shut down dissatisfaction with the war. So history is about these relationships with plants. And they can be raised up and integrated, you know, into social policy to help create a new culture, a new science, a new art, a more compassionate, caring, meaningful world. Or they can continue to be denied, like sexuality was denied and repressed until the work of Freud and Reich and the others made it just impossible to hold on to the myth any longer. But this choice of how quickly we mature into a community that can handle these things and address these issues is entirely with us. And certainly guys like Stan Grof and Bruce Eisner and the guys at Hopkins, and, you know, there are a number of them that have worked valiantly in this effort. But man, you can probably count them all on two hands and not miss anybody. So that's about it. Once again, I'll put the challenge out there into the community, the papers, the universities, the medical community. I welcome all comments. I'd love to see some of you talking about these things. I'd even welcome you on the program to have a discussion if you'd be so kind as to contact me. The others out there, put these people to task. They owe answers on this stuff. That goes for politicians, judges, cops, everyone else. I'd like to talk to every one of you, including the hemp cannabis issue, which no one will respond to at the papers or anywhere else in the progressive media of mid-Missouri. But hey, I'm just trying to save people some face, you know? I mean, there's going to come a time when you're going to have to answer the question, where were you? What were you doing? Why were you not covering this stuff? Look at Ron Paul. Look what he's doing. He's the guy that sponsored this 2007 hemp bill that's now in Congress, and he's being blacklisted big time by the mainstream media for the most part. But man, oh man, is that going to backfire? Holy cow. Just wait till you see what's going to happen. So anyway, I'm just doing the best I can, trying to share what I know, what I've learned, okay? All right, there are a bunch of questions, I'm sure. I'll peek into my email and in the chat room and come back and talk with you in a few minutes, okay? It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we'll play a song here called Last Tide, Sun Kill Moon, one more time, from Ghosts of the Great Highway on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. All right, everybody, Last Tide, that's called. Another song from Sun Kill Moon. And, well, back with you here. It's about 1:35 or so in the a.m. now, 15th of May. Just got a call from a listener named Carl, and he points something out that's important, and I want to make sure everyone knows I'm not giving medical advice or anything like that, but certainly if you are taking certain antidepressants, RSSI-type stuff, those are MAO inhibitors, long-term ones. That's why you tell you. That's why they tell you when you take them, you can't eat this, you can't do that. So certainly, if you're using any kind of prescription medication or you know any of this stuff, you have to be smart about what's going on. And you certainly do not want to introduce these things into your system at the same time. There are synergies between these things that have yet to be investigated and understood, and there's no business for that. Okay. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about it now in the meanwhile, because I've gotten a couple of questions that are important, I think, that came in email, and one from another guy who called during the break there. So the first one was a caller, and he says, "Hey, Mike, why are they used as party drugs? Why are the psychedelics used as party drugs here in the States?" And and this is my answer. Well, in our culture, and I'm going to speak only of psilocybin now, it's because we had no one to guide us on how to use these things. I mean, the real experience, the real deal, is so astonishing, so boundary dissolving that it's, you know, it can be scary. And in the 60s, a lot of people just wanted to do the stuff just to say they had done it. And, you know, as always, there's a lot of wannabes and posers, and a lot of people said they had been there, but in essence, they had done it once. You know, clenched their way through it and swore never to do it again. You know, so nowadays, very few people use psilocybin in a shamanic context. They take piddly doses and go to rock concerts with their friends. In other words, they take way too little and they do it in the wrong setting. And I recognize there's a recreational side to these things. That's okay. But that's only the superficial side of them. The correct way to really touch the mystery, as Terence taught, and I continue to, is a large dose by yourself or with a close friend who understands clearly what they are involved in on an empty stomach, in a quiet, safe space or in nature, with an attitude of reverence and respect and a desire to learn something. If you do that, you get the reward. And I continue to be astonished by how few actually are willing to do it. But in a shamanic culture, there are master shamans and elders that can teach a person proper technique and give a great deal of help and support before the veil is breached, if you know what I mean. In the West, we had no such luck. We thought in the 60s, these things had been discovered for the first time. And we were just flying blind. We had no understanding of the shamanic history. But now we do know. Maybe that's why it's taken 40 years to get some sense put into all of this. And you know, this is legal. In spite of all the propaganda you've heard, thanks to Richard Allen Miller, and I'm speaking of psilocybin right now, thanks to Richard Allen Miller and his book, The Ritual Use of Herbs, published in 1983, this kept psilocybin off the Uniform Controlled Substance List and allowed it to retain its legal status, as long as you're not distributing it or extracting the active compounds, you know, psilocin or psilocybin. As long as you're not doing those things, it's legal. And Richard assures me of this. I've done a little research on it in the last week or so, and I suggest you learn to grow. It is a fascinating hobby, if nothing else. Okay, in my email, this is sort of a rough one. I have a son who almost killed himself, strung out on dope for nearly 3 years. How do you address the children? All right, well, this is a real problem, and it speaks to the general state of the drug issue, which is one of utter ignorance and victimization. The government people, they whine and talk about education, but they have zero interest in education. I mean, what do you mean by dope? Strung out on dope, what do you mean? We have been so linguistically boxed in that we can't even differentiate between cocaine, cannabis, methamphetamine, LSD, whatever. An entire new vocabulary has to be created for both substances and the consequences. What we don't want, which I mentioned earlier, what we don't want is habitual, unexamined, obsessive behavior. We don't want it in drug use. We don't want it in commerce. We don't want it in education. We don't want it anywhere. Social relations, nothing. We just don't want it. Unexamined, habitual forms of activity that are obsessive. We don't want them. What we do want is conscious, caring, inquisitive, intelligent, self-examining human beings. So, in my opinion, anything that works against those ideas must be looked at as a drug. You see, then all of a sudden, things like television, money, propaganda, sugar, caffeine, you know, these all become seen as drugs, as great evils. In other words, you have to be smart. You have to be smart about your drug use. You have to be smart about all your relationships. And drugs are relationships. And the ones we're talking about tonight are relationships with plants. You have to be smart with all your relationships. To your plants, to your significant other or others, to your government, to your community, to your planet. And you're going to have to be smart to survive a situation on a planet such as the one we're in. You got to know the difference between good drugs and bad ones, helpful ones and harmful ones. And their legal status, by the way, has virtually no bearing on this classification. Now, our ancestors were smart. They got us here. And it must have been difficult. How many times, you know, did the ice come south and create islands of our collective family and divide us with big walls of ice, you know? Up until 100 years ago, we had essentially none of the benefits of technological civilization. So we need to be smart. And one way to be smart is to decondition. And our lives are not going to make any sense if we tolerate propaganda. You cannot be half free and half slave. You cannot be half hip and half dip. So you got to get smart and fast. And of course, this should be right at the top of the agenda for professionals in psychiatry and psychology. Because you're doing important work and people are coming to you for help. All right, we got time for one more here, I think. Let's see. All right, no problem, you guys on the chat. They're just listening in. They didn't want to add anything. I do have one more question here. I guess is a pretty good one, actually. I'm surprised I haven't talked about it yet. From email. Mike, please talk about the mushroom's personality, the mushroom as an entity. All right. Well, this is it, man. This is the central mystery of the whole business. This is the center of the mandala with regard to the mushroom experience. We're not just talking about passivity here. We're talking about an animated intelligence, a two-way path of communication and information flow. You know, it's an actual thing, an entity or a spirit or whatever. Maybe it's just the mushroom, or maybe it opens the door to something else. But it, whatever it is, it makes available an I-thou relationship, which can be developed. This is where things get so sketchy for us in the West, because we're taught to believe that any kind of talk like this is just wild silliness, you know, preposterous, because we have no place for intelligence in nature. So, is it E.T.? Is it Gaia? Is it autonomous fragments of the personality? I don't know. What I do know is that it is real, and that it is not rare. It's common on psilocybin, and it's repeatable. You know. So this animated intelligence is the main question. What is it? What's really going on? I mean, scientists reluctantly accept, you know, maybe with slim possibility, the idea that ET might exist, you know, the idea of an extraterrestrial intelligence. So we scan the skies looking for radio signals, you know, and all this sort of thing. You know, they might as well spend their time searching the heavens for a good Greek restaurant, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't think that's the way to find ET. At any rate, imagine, what would it do to the same science to find that another intelligence lived right next door and was able to access the human mind? So strange, this other, that it cannot be assimilated, cannot be reconciled, and yet so accessible that it's really just a matter of choice to decide if you want to stand in its amazing presence. I have no idea what the answer to this is. I think I'm fortunate to be able to ask the question. Because what we are working against is 500 years of programming and conditioning that we are finally able to wake up from, almost as if from a coma or a deadly illness, and say, my golly, nature is alive. It speaks. And I mean, this is not a metaphor, and I'm not a romantic, and this is not an artistic aesthetic stance. Nature is alive. Someone else is living in the house. Who is it? Your guess is as good as mine. But it is here, and it is making itself known, nonetheless. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's been wonderful talking with you all tonight. Let me drop in the chat real fast to say hello and goodbye to Ian, Micra, Sushi. As always, thanks so much. I appreciate it, okay? Next week, Paul Laffoley, the amazing Paul Laffoley, the music of the Bastard Fairies, and whatever else we decide to do. Going to cut things off a little early right now and say goodbye to you. Play one more on the way out here with Pancho Villa, wonderful song from Sun Kill Moon. Their CD that I've been drawing from this evening is called Ghost of the Great Highway. Wonderful stuff. Thanks to Mark Kozelek for making it available and for writing great songs and sharing wonderful music. And to everybody who listens to the program, as always, thanks. Come on back next week. We'll do it up again. Have a wonderful time in the meantime. And enjoy the summertime. It is here at long last. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Oh,
The Rhodesian nationalist leader, Bishop Abel Muzorewa, has accepted Mr. Smith's offer to negotiate an internal settlement based on one man, one vote. But, he says, there are conditions. These include stopping the execution of all captured prisoners of war, allowing Gibbons to take part in negotiations, being arrested. In Australia, Mr. Perry Packer's cricketers are still pleased about yesterday's High Court decision, which lifted the ban on them playing in test matches.
This is the voice of Allah, representative of the Ashtar Galactic Commander, speaking to you. For many years, you have seen us as knights in the stars. We speak to you now to serve esteem as we have done to your brothers and sisters all over this, your planet Earth. We come to warn you of the destiny of your race and your world so that you may connect to your fellow beings the course you must take to avoid the disaster which threatens your world and the beings on other worlds around you. This is in order that you may share in great awakening as the planet passes into the new age of Aquarius. The new age can be a time of great peace and evolution for your race, but only if your rulers are made aware of the forces that can overshadow their judgments. Be still now and listen, for your chance may not come again. All your weapons of evil must be removed. The time for conflict is now past, and the race of which you are a part may proceed to the higher stages of its evolution if you show yourselves worthy to do this. You have but a short time to learn to live together in peace and goodwill. Small groups all over the planet are learning this, and exist to pass on the light of the dawning new age to you all. You are free to accept the
many go as wide as then they run out.
Here now, the voice of Rilong, representative of the Ashtar Galactic Command, speaking to you. Be aware also that there are many false prophets and guides of prison operating on your world. They will suck your energy from you, the energy you call money, and will put it to evil ends, giving you worthless cost in return. But your divine self will protect you from this. You must not to be sensitive to the voice of him, but can tell you what is truth and what is true. Learn to listen to the voice of truth.
Really appreciate that we can't finish. I insist on it. So delicious. So it's only really choice ingredients. I can.
Have no fears. Seek only to know yourself and discover how is the weight of your territory. We need the Ashtar Galactic Command to your attention. We are now leaving the planes of your existence. May you be blessed by the supreme law and the weapons.
May I? Please do. Why, thank you. Tomato. Ah, scrumptious. Simply.
We understand that viewers in some parts of the region are receiving a breakthrough in sound. We're sorry about this, and we're doing our best to rectify the fault. Finally, back home, engineers are trying to trace the source of what they call a rogue transmission, which lasted about 6 minutes during ITN's early evening news bulletin. It affected viewers in the Berkshire and Hampshire area served by the Hannington transmitter. They heard a voice which cut across what I was reading. The voice said, "Earthlings, lay down your arms. This is a message from outer space." Well, thousands of viewers later phoned Salon Television, the police, and ITN here. A spokesman for the Independent Broadcasting Authority said, "This is the first incident of its kind in Britain." Winchester police said some people were frightened by the hoax message. They said they sent an officer to calm down one woman. Well, I hope nothing's interrupted this bulletin wherever you are this evening. From all of us here, good night. Independent Radio News at 12, David Geary. The Independent Broadcasting Authority is at a loss to explain the mysterious message that broke into a Southern Television news broadcast. The slow, deep voice proclaimed, in part, "All your weapons of evil must be destroyed. You only have a short time to learn to live in peace." The station was immediately besieged by worried telephone callers demanding an explanation. But as the information officer for the Broadcasting Authority, John Guinnery, says, there could be several different causes of the message.
Well, we don't know for sure that it was a pirate call. We know that there were some voices over saying certain things of which we haven't got an exact record. We've had a lot of accounts, obviously. A lot of people have been phoning us and other people about it. We simply don't know what it was. Broadcasts, of course, are monitored at an operations centre. But there was simply a mumble, and there was some picture distortion. We had a lot of reports in, but as I say, we simply don't know what it was.
Independent Radio News, it's 3 minutes past 12.